You're listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies, the Center for West European Studies, and the European Union Center at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/EU West Europe.
So I will also be talking about some of the history of the crisis, the energy crisis. So I think it's important to consider history in the beginning. It's beginning to look like this. This is not my slide. I did borrow. But it certainly expresses a widespread feeling in the EU. Now, this is a slide. This is information that I show to pretty much all of my energy related courses. It is a reality check. And I put it up here not because we are subjected to mis or disinformation, but because we can get a somewhat unrealistic view of what is happening in the global world of energy. I think Frank talked about this a little bit. In his answer to one of the questions. The truth about global energy is that oil, gas, and coal run the world. They run the great majority of it. And there are few signs that this is going to change in any very rapid way. That does not say that it is impossible for that change to take place, but it does say that we need to be realistic about what it will take to do this. I would emphasize the top three layers in this stratigraphic column. You'll excuse some of my geological metaphors. They are a hazard of the profession. So you'll see renewables and how rapidly it's grown. The lower scale is 2000s, so starting in 2000 and then every 3 years. This only goes up to 2021. That is the maximum for the data that is available now. It shows the decline in global energy demand and use during the pandemic, for the first portion of the pandemic, and then the very rapid recovery between 2020, the end of 2020, and then into 2021. That turns out to be a very crucial period with regard to the history of the European energy crisis that now continues. If we look at energy from a climate perspective, I would argue that it makes a great deal of sense to divide energy sources, not so much into renewables and fossil fuels, but into carbon and non-carbon sources. If we are truly serious about reducing emissions, that makes a great deal of sense. That is my opinion, and that is what I teach to my courses. It simplifies things to a certain degree, but interestingly, it also matches the approach of some countries who are very concerned about climate change. If you put your faith in renewables only, for the future, you see that you have a very small layer. If you include hydro, and this means large scale hydro, then you more than double that. If you include nuclear on top of that, which is a non-carbon source, then you get a combined non-carbon contribution to global energy that is growing quite rapidly. Certainly, in opposition to some of the fossil fuels. And it is significant. It is as significant almost as natural gas. So this becomes a different way of looking at things. And it is extremely relevant to Europe's energy crisis and its plan to deal with that. All right, now I'm going to talk about a few basic points and a question that the rest of this presentation will discuss. Europe faces the worst energy crisis in its history. This includes, by the way, the oil crises of the 1970s, 1973, 74, and then 1978, 79. Those were shocks. In Japan, they call it the oil shock, and that's certainly what it was in 1973, but it was just as much a shock later. Those were definitely very pivotal times. But the crisis facing Europe now is worse. It is more penetrative, it involves more of the countries, and it involves all aspects of their energy use. It is also, however, due to the weaponization of energy. We might even say, with a certain hesitation, we might call it the militarization of energy as well. The energy struggle between the West, because that's what it really involves, not just the EU, but the United States banning Russian petroleum fuels and UK doing the same, versus Russia. So you have the West versus Russia. Again, this is familiar territory to a certain degree, but perhaps we have to go back to the Stalin era to actually really understand what we are dealing with on the other side of the border between what once was the Warsaw Pact and is now part of Europe. So these are very pivotal times, I would say, epical times. There is a historical reorganization of the geopolitical map. And I'm talking about energy here, of course. And I'm focusing to a certain degree on oil and gas, which, as I said, still run the world, a significant part of it. This was part of the shock of the energy crisis in Europe. They suddenly had to face the mirror. But this was true for the United States and other advanced countries too, that those fuels have remained extremely important, even though they increased to a certain degree. We may have put too much faith in renewables before they actually deserve it. But the rearrangement of the geopolitical map also involves renewable technologies and it involves natural resources. As a geologist, that's a real focus of mine, and it is not a new thing. Geology and the Earth themselves are not democracies, and they have been very generous, I will put it that way, but not equal, and not everyone. The final thing that we'll talk about is the impact of this energy crisis, which really is, as the International Energy Agency puts it, a global crisis in many ways. What will the impact be going forward on the energy transition? I will say in the beginning that the energy transition is real and it is happening now. It's more slow motion than we would like, but we are seeing magnificent changes going forward. And I would point just to the advance in electric vehicles. That is an epochal change. That is a real pivotal change going forward. It will not be simple, it will not be quick, and it will not be cheap. Psychology needs to be changed, culture needs to be changed, as well as the technology and the infrastructure. But it is a very important change going forward. So the energy transition is real, and don't wish for anyone to think that it is just propaganda. Okay, now, cartoons have been very abundant in Europe talking about what is happening. The one that I would point to first is in the upper left, which may be a little bit difficult to understand. What you're seeing on the left side of that is Europe with its mouth wrapped around gas pipeline from Russia. And then you have Russia on the other side, Mr. Putin, of course, which, shirtless to show Russia's power and strength, with his mouth wrapped around the EU dollars that are coming in exchange. That's a, and then the dementia, it means tomorrow, I'll stop tomorrow, okay? but this is actually a pretty good representation of the mutual dependence that Europe itself depended upon going for a long time, thinking that Russia could not cut them off or do anything to injure that relationship. They were sorely disabused starting in late 2021, which I'll talk about in a moment. You see the energy crisis as the great snowball, and then you see Mr. Putin as the puppet master over Europe. So these are just a few. These are all in European newspapers, magazines. All right, so let's go over some of the background history. I show you the new Iron Lady of Europe. If that's not, I do not mean that in any but a complimentary way. Although I hesitate to call upon this statue in this, regard. So background history between 2010 and 2021, and I will show you some information on this, some actual data on this later. European reliance on Russian oil and gas went from around 15 to 16%, 17% in a big year, all the way up to 45% in some months, and even 50% in a few months. So this was a very rapid increase. Where did it come from? It did not come from great favoritism on the part of Europe towards Russia, and certainly not any love from Russia to Europe. Fact, conflictual rhetoric at the time was increasing. What was happening is that Europe's main suppliers from the North Sea particularly, but also from a giant gas field in the Netherlands named Groningen, they were beginning to deplete, and they depleted very rapidly. Who was actually beginning to decrease its overall demand, still needed a great deal of natural gas. This was a period of time, especially from 2010 to about 2018-19, when the U.S. was not able to ship any liquefied natural gas to Europe. It was waiting for permits from the federal government for export terminals. Before the fracking revolution, which really began around 2005 and 2008 in the US and started with natural gas, the US was importing a significant portion. And so there were import terminals along the Gulf Coast and in portions of California and the West Coast and also in the East Coast. Those terminals, once the fracking revolution began, it's not just fracking, it's the shale as well. The amount of natural gas that the US was producing shot up very, very rapidly. And so applications were made to turn those import terminals into export terminals. And that took a few years to happen. So the U.S. was not able to come to Europe's rescue, and there were few other sources than Russia. The other aspect is that Russia had a massive pipeline system that went, it was originally built by the Soviets to feed and to quiet resistance in the Warsaw Pact countries. So those countries could depend on the Soviet Union for all of their oil and gas. Essentially, except for Romania, which was the only country that had some oil of its own. Later in the Cold War, during the 1980s, that pipeline system which is the largest in the world, was extended into Western Europe. During the 1980s, Russia benefited a great deal from foreign currency, hard currency. And that came from the selling of oil and gas to Western Europe, most central and Western Europe. Okay, so Europe allowed itself to become very, very heavily dependent on Russia, thinking that Russia was also just as dependent on the EU for income. And this was an idea that was that became kind of boilerplate. It was accepted by energy experts in the United States and in Japan, and certainly in Europe itself. This was a fixed idea for quite a while, that Russia could not risk its connections with Europe in terms of natural gas. But this proved to be less of a factor overall than Mr. Putin's designs on Ukraine. Now, Russia, or I should say Moscow, to be more precise, or the Kremlin, to be still more precise, or a part of the Kremlin. In any case, you get the point, had been showing its hand for quite a while, turning the gas on and off through Ukraine in the 1990s because of lack of payment and because of certain political predispositions as well to try and keep Ukraine within the Russian zone of influence. So Russia had been using its natural gas, particularly as a weapon against Ukraine, since the early 1990s. The reason Europeans didn't pay attention then was that their gas level was completely supplied by Norway and Britain and Dutch and the Groningen field. So they got very small amounts of gas from Russia and Russia's relationship to its former states was more viewed in terms of military than in energy. This is a long story, but it is very important as a background. Now, in the summer, and the fall of 2021 is when demand for oil and gas, after lockdown ended, began to surge worldwide, but especially in Europe and China. And at this very moment, Russia began reducing its gas supply to Europe. It was still meeting its contracted volumes, but at a very, very low level. And this was being done at the same time that the natural gas market worldwide was getting very tight and prices were rising. So it didn't make sense for Russia to, you know, be doing this on purpose. And all kinds of, I don't know, this isn't that long ago, but you may not, if you didn't keep up with the literature, you know, about energy and natural gas, you wouldn't have seen this because it didn't get many headlines. But they began, this is Gazprom, began reducing the flow, especially through Ukraine. And the hope was clearly to throw Europe off balance before the invasion happened about 6 months later. And it created confusion and anxiety, and there were all kinds of excuses made by Gazprom. Oh, we have all of these maintenance issues, and no, you're receiving the right amount, and it was just a real game of pretense. But now, in retrospect, we see that it was planned, and even into the winter, Gazprom continued to decrease. It would increase 1 month and decrease the next, and then it would do this on a weekly basis. So it was really baiting the Europeans and throwing them off balance before the late February invasion. This is important history as well. Then in the spring, February, Russia invades Ukraine and the oil and gas prices go sky high, very rapid. course. The EU did not lie down. And this was one of Mr. Putin's largest assumptions that proved to be wrong. He thought, especially after the invasion and the seizure of Ukraine, of the Crimea in 2014, when Europe really didn't do very much. Some sanctions, but they certainly didn't decrease their dependence on Russian gas. In fact, it increased from 2014 to 2018. So Mr. Putin, with some amount of reason, I don't want to give him too much credit for this or for anything else, but the point was he had a precedent for this, and he thought Europe would kind of lay down and not do anything significant. But Europe stood up, and it became very clear very quickly that they were going to reduce and perhaps cut completely off and even ban Russian supply, particularly of oil and gas, but also coal. Nuclear is a different issue. Talk about that in a little while. That still remains to be seen. But certainly, it's the sources of Russia's main revenue, export revenue, oil and gas, and petroleum fuels. Should add that in there. With the price getting so high, the U.S. Decided to shift a lot of its LNG that it was then sending around the world, including to Japan, South Korea, China, and parts of South America and to parts of Europe. It decided to ship at least 60% of its total LNG. Now, I'm talking about to the EU. Now, I'm talking about the US. Now, the US does not have a national oil and gas company, but the way, say, Saudi Arabia or Russia, Kuwait, or Indonesia or Mexico do. It has hundreds, actually thousands, of private companies and publicly owned companies. So what was driving the change was more the market price of natural gas. But this was encouraged also by the federal government and by state governments. There was a fair bit of talk to large producers in the shale patch, as they call it, that can make a lot of money and you can help our allies. But the most the federal government could really do at the time is encourage that, although there was some discussion about lowering royalty rates. The federal government charges on its own lands. But that wouldn't have had much of an effect because most of the shale drilling is on private land, fee land. But the U.S. came to the rescue, and it did it in February and March, in the cold months, and it really had a significant impact. It did not prevent the crisis. The U.S. just did not have enough gas to export to do that. And companies decided not to send all of their gas there. So the crisis happened. It was not as bad as it could have been, but it was bad. I'll show you some images later. And this involved the UK as well as the EU and most other countries. And then it involved really the world, because oil prices, oil is a global market, and natural gas is close to being a global market. So everyone was paying more. And this was the time when oil prices went sky high, and therefore gasoline prices in the US went up. And of course, the political conflict over that, we know that the president, as the one who sits on high, you know, is responsible for all of this needs to be blamed. But in fact, Mr. Biden couldn't do much. He did a lot more than other presidents had. He released a lot of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, 180 million barrels. No one had ever done anything like that. 50 million was the largest amount released. prior to that. Now, spring and fall 2022, which hopefully we can all remember, Russia begins to shift its supply to India and China. And it does this at a major discount, about a $30 discount from the global price, from the global market price. And China was interested, but India was even more interested. India has a higher demand increase than China has at this point. India had just a trickle from Russia before this, and that turned into a river. And it has remained that up to the present, and will probably continue that way, at least for several more years, if not more. India is at a state of its development that China was at in the late 2000s. So it is motorizing very rapidly. It's using oil to generate electricity, but it's using a lot of it for its industry, which is expanding. And it is making use of coal, which is what it has as the greatest energy resource that can be exploited right now, just as China. So Russia was able to ship a fair bit of its exports to India, China, and a few other countries. Turkey was one, and a few countries in Southeast Asia. But this did not make up for the total loss that Europeans, that the EU represented. That was Russia's major market. By far. And so that the EU would stand up to Russia had real impact. And it has had an impact, but the real impact is coming this year and 2024, 2025, going forward. And I'll talk about that a bit more in a moment. This is a diagram or a map, I should say, of Russia with its pipeline systems, showing its major pipelines, natural gas and oil. Natural gas is red and oil is blue. It should be green. That's what we usually use. What it's showing is that the vast majority of this pipeline system leans to the west, just as it did during the Soviet times. And there are a few that are going east. But in terms of its ability to deliver via pipeline, Russia is definitely leaning far to the west. And with Europe now having a mission to cut that off, a lot of this pipeline system is going to go either, which is very interesting to contemplate. The ESPO, which is the East Siberian Pacific Ocean pipeline, was completed in 2013. And the Power of Siberia, which is a natural gas pipeline, that's the Power of Siberia 1, was completed, those dash lines, except for the Power of Siberia 2, the dash lines further east are all solid now. That was completed in 2018-2019. So Russia has two export terminals, one on Sakhalin Island and one down in Kozima, which is near Vladivostok. Those are small export terminals in terms of the volumes that can actually be sent to other countries. The larger export terminals are in the Arctic, in the Yamal Peninsula, that's natural gas, and then over in the Baltics as well. So this is, Russia is very constrained infrastructurally to deliver large amounts of oil to China and India in a relatively rapid way. I wanted to emphasize with this map, which gives you a sense of our arteries, actual kind of biological connection, of the degree to which Russia has built out its dependence on Europe. This gives you a kind of a more visceral look at that dependence. I let me go back just here I am. Thank you for your patience. I wanted to point out that the Nord Stream 1 and the Nord Stream 2 that you see at the top left, those are the two largest the two largest volume capable pipelines into Europe. They can deliver 55, probably, as Nord Stream 1 was actually delivering about 57, probably 60 billion cubic meters a year. Those two would be able to, if they were being used, both could deliver about a third of Europe's gas needs, just those two pipelines. Now, if you look down to the south, it's a little bit difficult to see, but there are two other pipelines that cross the Black Sea. One is called Turk Stream and the other is called Blue Stream. These were all built, the Nord Stream and the Turk Stream, Blue Stream were all built to circumvent supply around Ukraine. It was in a dramatic sense, it was a great pincer play. But this was part of the evidence that Russia was using its gas as not a weapon, then definitely a tool of foreign policy from the 2000s and even earlier on. So those were each multi-billion dollar pipelines. But at the same time, not as much was built going to the east. So I wanted to emphasize that. Okay. So Mr. Putin was very happy to see the EU, how their dependence on natural gas rose and rose and rose through the 90s. In the beginning, that had to do with demand, and it was mostly replacing coal with natural gas. But you can see that during the 2000s, it slows down quite a bit. And that was because of the depletion in the North Sea and in the Groningen field and the Netherlands also. But then starting about 2012, you see a very rapid increase, and that is all Russian gas. Okay, that's European dependence rising. So between about 2013 and 2018, when it reached a maximum, that is all new dependence on Russia. So most of this really took place after the seizure of Crimea. Now you'll notice that the dependence on imports of oil is very, very high. This is EU dependence, so it does not include Norway, which is a major supplier. Some analysts consider Norway to be a domestic supplier, but in fact, it's exogenous. Fancy word of saying it's not really part of the EU, but it's not Russia, obviously. So this is a more detailed view of Europe's dependence, or Europe's and the UK dependence on natural gas and the sources of that. If you look at the lowermost layer, which is labeled domestic production, and see, it includes the UK. The UK was, as we know, not part of Europe for a few years now. You see how rapidly that has decreased after 2010. You also see that the next layer above that, brown layer, that is from Norway. And that amount has decreased slightly, but it has remained the same also. It just has not increased. Among the layers that increase the most is that of Russia. And so this leads to a kind of question, doesn't it? What rule of geopolitics did the EU break? And these were decisions that were made mostly on economic grounds. Pipeline gas from Russia is cheaper, considerably cheaper than LNG from wherever, from the United States, or at the time, much more from Qatar and from Australia, and to some degree from Indonesia and Malaysia as well. So these decisions about increasing gas flow from Russia were made even as Russia became more belligerent towards the West. And those of you that have kept up with sort of the military dimension of this know that Russian planes have been invading Scandinavian UK airspace very consistently over the last 5 to 6 years, that submarines have been within national waters of Scandinavia and gone through the English Channel. There have been a lot of these kinds of provocations that were quite typical of portions of the Cold War. But they certainly don't provide a lot of basis for a hope for complete peace between the two sides. So the EU was kind of playing two games. They were watching what was happening with Russia, but they weren't transmitting that to their decisions about natural gas, about a very crucial part of their needs. Okay, so the security story. I've tried to give you an idea. There are two sides to this. This will make it even clearer. So on the left here, I have Europe's risk exposure to Russian gas cutoff. So this is essentially the dependence level of these various countries. And this is natural gas, not oil. So you can see Latvia is quite high, Hungary, Austria, very high, Germany, like Germany dependent for as much as 55% of its gas on Russia. Whereas France is very low, Spain is quite low. Spain gets a fair bit of its gas from Algeria, pipeline under the Mediterranean, and didn't need as much because of its nuclear. Okay. Now, here's the other side of that, okay? The other side of the security question is NATO. Long ago, during the Cold War, it was said that the North Sea had become a NATO lake. What has happened now with Finland's admission is that the Baltic Sea is now a NATO lake. This is one of the main corridors that Russia uses to export its natural gas to Japan. So this is a very significant geopolitical change. Even if Sweden is stalled by Hungary and Turkey going forward, this will remain. Okay. This is estimated revenue from fossil fuel exports in Russia in 2022. From March into December, I'm just pointing out here that it has decreased significantly. Crude oil, however, has remained fairly high for Russia, but the natural gas, pipeline gas, has gone way down. Oil products have remained significant. As has coal, mostly to Asia, and LNG is pretty strong. But pipeline gas has gone down. So Russia is losing revenue to this point, but it is also maintaining a pretty strong revenue stream. Okay, I'm gonna skip this. And I wanted to explain why Russia is able to move as much oil and petroleum products as it has. Oh, all right, okay. just trying to pay attention to time.
Fair
enough. So this is on the left, this is Russia, this is Europe's dependence on Russia this is Russia's natural gas exports. This is Russia's dependence on Europe. OECD Europe. So 72% of Russia's exports of natural gas went to Europe. So you can see that Putin making this decision, he was relying very heavily on Europe just lying down and letting things happen in Ukraine. And then you see Asia and Oceania, and then you see non-OECD Europe and Eurasia. This was a huge gamble at this part, much larger than he had anticipated. On the right is a more detailed look at the decrease in pipeline gas exports to the EU. And so you can see that they tumbled after the invasion in early 2022. They will go to zero probably later this year. That is the bulk of Russian exports of gas, about 60 to 65%. So they will be trying to move much more gas by LNG, by liquefied natural gas, which means by tanker. And sanctions have been focused on tankers and marine insurance of tankers and also their crews. That hasn't actually been discussed very much, but crews are being sanctioned if they are working on behalf of Russian exports of fossil fuels. Russia, however, has taken advantage of what are called dark tankers. This is something that experts in the oil market have known about. Iran, China have been using them for quite a while. North Korea has been using them. A number of other states use them here and there when they are sanctioned. Venezuela has used them for a little while, but not as much. But Russia is using them at a much greater level than has happened before. There are about 400 of them. There's somewhere between 600 and 800 of these tankers. Most of them are small. That means they don't have the very, very large cargoes of oil and petroleum products that the ultra large the carriers, the ULCCs or the VL, very large cargo carriers. And they're old, some are heavily rusted, and there is a real fear about spills. They operate mostly at nighttime. They turn their transponders off. They take pathways that do not necessarily go through the Suez Canal. When you go through the Suez Canal, Egyptian pirates are in charge of taking you through there. So they don't usually go through unless they can bribe people to do this. And there are people willing, you know, it's a big world, as my mother used to say. So they often go around Cape of Good Hope, and they'll go around, they won't go through the Straits of Malacca, or they'll go through the Straits at nighttime and try and escape too much notice. But this is a lot of tankers, and this moves a significant amount of oil. Most of these tankers are oil and petroleum products, not LNG. So they are going to Asia, specifically to China and India, to Turkey. There is a dark fleet in the Black Sea. It's not very large, but it's significant. And it's all at discounted prices. Some of the oil that is coming from the Ural Mountains, which is really very high quality crude, is now selling for around $54 because it's mostly loaded. It's sent to the Black Sea to one of the Novorossiysk port there. And so it's kind of a buyer's market to a certain degree. there is no chance that these tankers and the two export terminals on the east coast of Russia will replace all of what it's sent to Europe. But it will supply significant amounts of money going forward, as long as this is able to continue to feed the war against Ukraine. So what Frank said is absolutely true. It's not as if Russia isn't suffering. Its economy is actually suffering significantly, mostly for the people, of course. And that is going to get much worse. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. So the crisis for Europe was real, but it was much less than feared. And the four reasons for this is that the EU worked really hard, and so did its people, to reduce gas demand. The governments were mainly in charge, but the people, they weren't happy about it. But they turned down their thermostats, they reduced their gas use particularly. In some places they drove less. The governments subsidized energy use, particularly of industry, in some cases consumers, but not enough. New gas supplies came to the rescue, mostly from the US, but also from more sent or directly, I should say, from Qatar and Australia. But the US was really very important, more important than those two put together. And Europe lucked out because they had a very mild winter. If it had been a very seriously cold winter, the crisis would have cost many lives. That's almost certain. And Dr. Lohmann pointed that out. But people truly suffered. I don't want to take away from that reality. And that tells us how serious Europe was. People were biting their nails week by week to see what the weather would do during the winter. Now, there's another side to that, and that is this coming winter. The International Energy Agency, which is sort of the data clearinghouse in renewable energy, does predict another crisis, or I should say another crunch. Europe does need more gas, even though it has been very successful in filling its storage. It has not done that enough, and it still uses gas quite a bit. In fact, Europe uses gas more than the US does for heating and cooking. Okay, and then what is the US role going to be? This is a massive question, and no one knows, no one can answer. Oil companies in the shale patch say that they are not going to increase production. Prices are too low, and they've already drilled up the best places. I'm not convinced, as someone who knows the industry pretty well, I'm not convinced. There is a better than 50-50 chance that the demand will increase worldwide, and that will push prices up in the US because it exports so much. And if it gets $1 or $2 higher than it is now, it's about $2 for a million BTUs, that will be enough to get some more drilling or higher production. But, you know, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. One thing about the EU plan, they have a major plan going forward. And I'll go over this pretty quickly, so forgive me. Because I am straining time. This is a diagram from the EU page. So they have three major approaches: accelerate clean energy. Now notice that says clean, and they mean non-carbon energy. Diversify energy sources, in other words, obey the demands of energy security. And save energy. How do you do that? Efficiency. one of the main, and also technological change, one of the main pushes in Europe right now, and this is across Europe, is for heat pumps to be used. Heat pumps are a source that would reduce total energy use, certainly reduce natural gas use enormously. They're powered by electricity, so it would put some pressure on power generation. But heat pumps are another part of the energy transition, and this is accelerating in Europe. And it is very interesting. It's something to be really mindful of. Also in the United States, this is a push in Seattle area, as a matter of fact. We have one in our house, and it's great. So anyway, no company endorsements here. Europe's target now, whether it's realistic or not, is to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by more than half, by 55%, by 2030. Now, are there any problems with this? Yes, there definitely are. How do you define clean and sustainable? And this is where the nuclear problem comes in. And the EU is still fighting this. Just last week, the battle between France and Germany over nuclear was partly decided by the EU Commission that they would accept nuclear. Germany is, I have to say, is something of an outlier on that to a significant degree, but it is an important outlier. But pretty much every state in Eastern Europe is pro-nuclear. As you saw from Frank and Alexander, Poland has big plans and could set a new precedent in Europe. But biofuels, the Germans argued, no, we can't get rid of all gasoline and diesel. Because we have biodiesel and we make a lot of it. So, you can't do that. And that was a source of huge discussion, argument. And then Finland and some of the Scandinavians want forest waste to be very high, but the Germans argue against that because it incentivizes cutting down forests. And so it's the EU, right? You've got a lot of different countries with different resources and different points of view on energy. Nothing's going to be simple. So can energy security and climate policy be combined? Really, I mean really, because it's said that it can be done all the time. But now is the time to look and see in a crisis situation whether the EU can do this. Because if they can, and if they are successful, they will be the leaders in the energy transition. Make no mistake. The question about China is very, very much in the foreground. According to articles in the Financial Times and Deutsche Welle and some other places, they are not willing to exchange Russia for China. And China does control the majority of the market for lithium and for rare earth metals, and for the technology itself. And so a big push for Europe is to generate these new industries for itself. And that will make Scandinavia very important as a resource-rich portion of the EU. This is what's happening in the US also, and in some other countries, this kind of new mercantilism, to give it an ugly term for economists. So there are major changes going forward. I want to end on the historic reshuffling of global energy. So I'll go through this. This is a very, very interesting time with regard to oil and gas. Those fuels will not go away. Those sources are not going to disappear. They're going to be important at least for another decade, maybe two. Well, they'll be important for longer than that. In terms of ruling the transport and the heating and power generation domains, it's anybody's guess at this point. But now we have a complete shift. The US has now become the major supplier of oil, petroleum fuels, and natural gas to the OECD nations. It has replaced OPEC to a very significant degree. For those of us that are, that were born in the early Holocene period, this is a different planet. This is completely different. It's not that the Klingons are now in charge, but it is radically different. On the other side, Russia will now be a major supplier to illiberal states. And that means China and India, and there's a number of other countries, Turkey as well. It means countries in Africa and potentially in South America as well. So what does this have to do with the decay of the international order that's going on? You have these two energy blocks. It will be connected with oil and gas. It's already happened, and it'll just increase. This is a big question going forward. This is a very big geopolitical change. Oil is still very important. The US and Russia now are both major competitors to OPEC. Okay, this big change has possibly broken up an agreement between OPEC and Russia to control prices, but now they are competing. Saudi Arabia, until 2022, was the largest supplier of oil and petroleum fuels to China. Now it's Russia. So a big question going forward, will they still work together or will they not? Can the US produce enough to offset that? OPEC just this week cut their output so they could raise prices. Can the U.S. actually increase production to offset that kind of control? The other side to this is that OPEC and Russia have absolutely no incentive right now to engage in any really serious commitment to the energy transition. I don't think either of them are really serious about it anyway, but that's my opinion. And it's probably worth what you pay for it. But those are the signs. This is a very interesting dimension to the present. Competition between the EU and the US for leadership of the energy transition. There is an argument going on now, and I'm sure that some of my listeners have seen this, about the IRA. I'm not talking about Ireland. I'm talking about the recent law, the Inflation Reduction Act, which provides an enormous financial incentive for renewable industries to be set up in the United States. And the EU wants to do that on their own ground. And there are a number of European companies that are very interested in coming to the U.S. They consider the financial rewards much bigger. And so there have been some major complaints from France, particularly about this, but also Spain. So can the EU and the U.S. work together, right? Which is really what we need. So I leave you with that question. I've said more than enough, and I want to thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Finally, after this.